Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in the and the sun is eclipsed by the moon.
Hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben, and hi, everybody.
Hi, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. You can also catch us live on the internet at us at dublincityfm.ie. And also as a podcast. And with the nights closing in, it's time to look at what to see in the sky
over
the coming week or so.
Yeah, nothing really much to see there.
Well, the morning sky.
Yeah, the morning. Really, that's
if you're up early.
Yep. So Mercury still very low in the glow of sunrise. Just wait till next week when it comes back for a little bit more viewing. Venus and Jupiter shine together in the east before and during dawn. Venus being the brighter one, of course, at 4.0 on the scale and minus 1.9
For Jupiter.
The two brightest permanent celestial objects after the Sun and Moon. And Saturday the 16th, they're going to be 4 degrees apart, which is not that far apart. So Jupiter, of course, on the top as well. Mars, unfortunately, months ago, it was brilliant. Now it's 1.6, it's in the head of Virgo at the moment. It still glimmers very low in the west in evening twilight. In evening twilight, yeah. And binoculars, of course, will help. Saturn, plus 0.8, it's in Pisces at the moment. And it rises around the end of twilight, so it's lower right of the Great Square of Pegasus, if one knows where that one is, which now stands on one corner, diamond fashion, of course. So best time to observe Saturn with the telescopes in the early hours of the morning, with the high area being in the south. We see Saturn's rings almost edge on this year. And probably not my favourite way of seeing it. I'd love to see it back to its original, about 23 degrees there. Wouldn't it be lovely to see them face on?
It would, but yeah, that's not possible
for no.
From Earth.
That'd be lovely.
You're going to have to take a trip into space for that one.
Yeah, indeed. Uranus 5.7, virtually impossible to see with the human eye, so you need a pair of binoculars or a good telescope. And Neptune plus 7.8, which is really, really dim, lurks hardly more than 1 degree from Saturn in the early morning hours. So things are changing up there. They keep swapping and changing. And it'll be a little while before they come in line again like they did earlier on in the year. So just have to keep and fingers crossed that everything is okay and the clouds disappear. We don't like clouds.
Not when we're trying to observe, that's for sure.
No.
Thank you, John. Tonight the Perseid meteor shower peaks. We'll get to that in a moment, but because unfortunately bad timing from this year, because kind of almost full moon. Does interfere a lot. Speaking of the moon, well, it's just past full. It's 85% waning gibbous moon at the moment. Currently, it's not above our horizon here in Dublin, but it will arise just before 10 p.m. this evening, and it will be due south when it's at its highest at 4:30 in the morning, before it sets at 11:25 a.m. tomorrow morning, before rising again just after 10 p.m. tomorrow evening. By that stage, it will be down to 75% waning gibbous moon. And the sun will rise tomorrow in Dublin. That's Wednesday the 13th at 6:01. Tomorrow morning, that's 11 minutes later than a week ago. And a local noon when the sun is due south and at its highest, it's 1:29 p.m. Sun sets 8:56 p.m. Can you believe it's before 9 now, before it sets from our vantage point here in Dublin. That's a whole 14 minutes earlier than a week ago. And then we have various shades of twilight until 11:35 p.m. tomorrow evening, when astronomical twilight ends and nighttime officially begins. So tomorrow another 3 minutes 35 seconds less daylight than today, which means there'll be 26 minutes less daylight than a week ago, and there will be 14 hours and 55 minutes between sunrise and sunset. John, the Perseids, tonight they peak, but they will be around for some time.
Until the 23rd.
Thereabouts, yeah. But tonight is, the best night numerically to see them.
Yeah, well, I'm going spotting, definitely.
You're going later?
Oh, I'm definitely
Well, I know later. Some IAS people will be on, I believe, at Hoth Summit evening.
Good.
They're meeting up there at 10 p.m., which is, as I just mentioned, that the moon will rise just about then, and the sun will be setting. Well, we'll be into nautical twilight at that stage. So you will see assuming there are clear skies, of course, we should get to see a good view, because it does peak today now under the most ideal conditions, in the darkest skies ever, with no moon. You might see 100 one every hour, but tonight, maybe, with a bit of luck, you might see 20, but still 20 an hour is...
It's still pretty good, yeah.
It's two every 6 minutes, one every 3 minutes, and they are one of the brightest ones. A meteor shower of the year, as the Earth slams into some debris left by the comet Swift-Tuttle.
And we bomb through that at 70,000 miles an hour, and it takes us weeks to get through it. So that's a big, big comet. So just to let you know, and I was asked this question, where exactly in the sky do you need to be to watch the Perseid meteor shower? So if you can find Cassiopeia, which is the big W in the sky, which a lot of us know, and on the beginning of the W, just below it, in between, it's actually bang in the middle of Perseus and Cassiopeia. That's where they radiate from, and they come in any different angles. So it's
you can see them at any point in the sky, but they all seem to originate. If you trace the line back, they all seem to originate back in Perseus, or... Perseus, hence the name.
Perseids, Comet Swift-Tuttle. It comes around and orbits the sun every 135 years. Now, I'm just trying to figure out when it was seen last night. I didn't Google that.
Google it?
I
haven't done that
we
either.
We do it every year. It's very, very accurate. With a bit of luck, now we'll get to see a few tonight. It's looking good so far. And I will be up to watch a few of those beetling through the skies and into the atmosphere as well. So look up towards the Cassiopeia W. That's the one to watch for, and they're quite easy to see, and some of these are very, very big, so you'll get to see some nice showers as well. So really the time best, I suppose, is midnight and just before dawn, although you will get to see them probably from 10 o'clock on as we just twist into the path of the meteor shower, and hopefully we'll get to see more than 10 to 20 per hour, a little bit more. A little umbrella or something block out the moonlight somehow, that's the way it goes, but it's unfortunately 85% lit or thereabouts, which sort of dims a lot of the stuff in the skies. So just set your alarm clock for later on.
Thank you, John. And of course we had some sad news. Another legend of an astronaut, Jim Lovell, died. He had a pretty good innings, and as far as he was 97 years of age, he died last Thursday. One of three people to travel as far as the moon twice. Now, he never got to walk on the moon. That was the plan, as he was not only in Apollo 8, was it Apollo 8? It was Apollo 8, which orbited the moon. I think that was the first Apollo to go as far as, the first people to go as far as the moon. It did orbit the moon, and he was back on his way to the moon on the famous Apollo 13 journey, when those famous words that we've all heard of, Houston, we have a problem, arose. But, You may have. Did you see the film Apollo 13?
I did. I only watched it about. Well, I've seen Tom Hanks's one a couple of years back at this stage, but I did watch the original just recently.
He had a cameo part in that, Jim Lovell, when they got back from the splashdown, and then they're picked up at the helicopter and landed back on the aircraft carrier, mm-hmm. and one of, I think it's the commander of the ship, I'm not sure, but somebody on the ship. There's people there to greet him. Tom Hanks playing Jim Lovell, and one of those people is Jim Lovell. You see, shake his hand. And
yeah, nice to see. Definitely.
So, just by way of interest, I suppose the other two people to travel to the moon twice were John Young on Apollo 10, which also orbited the moon, and he was also there on Apollo 16, and Gene Cernan also on Apollo 10, and he was on Apollo 17 as well, which was, of course, the last landing of the moon. So, he was certainly...
He was a test pilot as well.
Pilot, yeah. Most of those astronauts were test pilots.
Yeah. The reactions must be very, very quick.
And had to be fairly calm under pressure and knew the risks and just... They had to be made of the right stuff. which is why that film was called The Right Stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You have to be a certain character to seen the Saturn V rocket, you have to be you definitely have to be of a certain character to sit on top of one of them.
Set a big firework.
I'm listening to a podcast. There's a podcast at the moment, 13 Minutes to Moon, from the BBC World Service, episode 4 or so. But and he's talking to some, including Gene Cernan, actually, and the people who did the programming of the first time there was a fly-by-wire craft was actually Apollo 7 or 8. I think it was 8. Mm. Oh, yeah. And what was my point about that? But, yes, he's saying that when they lit the fuse, so you know, ignition sequence start, and he thought, is it supposed to happen? They had trained so many times for it, but there was nothing like the shaking and the vibrating, and yes, it lifted so slowly off the launch pad. So, are we going to get off at all? But it was
probably about 100 miles an hour before it hit the top of the takeoff. What do they call the big gantry that holds them up? Yeah, so they didn't really take off that slowly.
No, it just probably it was quite felt slow. Like well, it was the acceleration was pretty fast, but it was kind of slow. And it took a few seconds to clear the tower, and then it just
compared to nowadays when they just hit the power button and off they go, they're literally instant.
Mm.
Yeah,
but it's a good podcast. I definitely recommend a lot of repetition in it. Now, it goes back to. I find that part about the AGS jet, Apollo guidance system, basically the first type of computer, and how it worked. It's really, really fascinating. And there's only a few kilobytes of memory in it, and of course they play a lot of the audio, which is available, but the guys, Armstrong and, of course, Aldrin, when the 1202 alarm came on, 1202, the alarm, the computer was flashing like nuts, and he's waiting for a response back from Houston as to what's that issue, and he gets a bit irate then after about 10 seconds, says, I need an answer, what's this? I'm paraphrasing now, but I need an answer, what's this 1202 alarm? So it's basically, and they were only a few minutes from landing, so it was touch and go whether to abort the mission or whether to carry on. But anyway, we know what happened.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Indeed, the two crewmates that were with them were a fellow called Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes. They're sort of names that don't really gel in the back of your mind. You know, you're all used to Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and all those guys sitting in cramped conditions, suffering massive dehydration and hunger for 3.5 days while concocting the way back to Earth with the crippled spacecraft. So that's a shame. He did well, 97. Been through radiation belts and all sorts of things and still made it to 97. And a pleasant chap as well.
Yes, thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast.
You know, I was following this last week when the four astronauts were due to take off or take back from the International Space Station. They did come home after a nice big splashdown on four parachutes. The international crew of these four came back home on Saturday after nearly 5 months aboard the International Space Station, returning safely in a SpaceX capsule. So the astronauts, Anne McLean and Nicole Ayers, Japan's Takuya Onishi and Russian cosmonaut Kirill Peskov. They splashed down off the California coast at 25:04 GMT, which was 8:44 AM over the other side of the Atlantic, and the return marked the end of the 10th crew rotation mission to the space station under NASA's commercial crew program. So the Dragon capsule of billionaire Elon Musk's SpaceX company detached from the International Space Station at 22:15 GMT and Friday and gently parted and made its way back here to Earth. And of course they endured 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit or almost 2,000 degrees Celsius on the outside of the capsule. And strange thing about these capsules are not very thick metal-wise in these as well. So it's a remarkable feat to get something up and down, you know, this way. So welcome home, the gang who were there for 5 months.
Thank you, John. And thank you to Ashley and Wicklow for your text. Love to hear what you think about Comet 3i Atlas. Is it indeed a comet? Well, I've heard it's a comet.
Yeah.
And it seems to certainly be passing through the solar system. I did read up on the details of it, all right, and I know it's been tracked for a while, and you can definitely do the maths and figure out from its trajectory and its path that it's not in an orbit around the sun and that it's going so fast it'll whiz. Whiz past, in and out.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say quick as a flash, but it's going to take a few years, actually.
Yeah.
I think it nears perihelion around, isn't in October, and after that. But some people are predicting to be magnitude plus 12. So that's, you're not going to see that with a pair of binoculars.
No.
You'll need a reasonably good telescope to see it. I did see a quick video of it the other day, but basically it was a dot moving. Could be, yeah.
Yep. And
anything, but
the fact that it's moving just proves that it is either a comet or an asteroid. We're taking it as a comet at the moment. We'll do a little bit more research in it over the next week or so, just to see if we can help on that one as
Ashley,
well.
Yeah.
Yep, indeedy.
Thank you.
Now, NASA racing to put nuclear reactors on the moon and Mars. So the two of them are rushing to put nuclear power reactors on the moon and Mars and then hopes to launch the first system by the end of the decade. So what's happening there, they're looking to, I suppose, populate the moon, and if they're going to lose power by normal means when the sun disappears, as you know, the way that you go into a darker spot.
Two weeks of daylight and two Earth weeks of daylight and then two Earth weeks of darkness.
So they need a constant power supply up there to power whatever they need with computers and living quarters, all that sort of stuff. And it'll be interesting to see now. Nuclear. They don't need an awful lot of power, really, wattage-wise, to do that. Because it's just one of those things that they produce so much power in these nuclear reactors. It's they're only going to power a few lights here and there, computers.
Maybe so. There is, of course, this again is another geopolitical type of situation, because since sometime last year, China and Russia, they've announced at least three times since then that they were involved in a joint effort to place a reactor on the moon by the mid-2030s. And apparently the first country to do so, you could declare a keep-out zone if you had a nuclear thingy. So you
could
declare that, oh, this is belonging to us.
And, yeah, keep out.
And that would inhibit anybody else from going anywhere near us. If, let's say, for example, as the Americans do with Artemis 3, they want to land on the near the South Pole.
Mm.
And if somebody else got there, put their reactor there first, you could... Well, I don't know what you could legitimately claim that. Of course, you'd want to keep other people away from it.
Yeah. Put a fence up. Keep out. Yeah. Now, when I said that it didn't take an awful lot of power, it's only dealing about 100 kilowatts, which is, we're not talking megawatts here, we're talking just kilowatts to support long-term human operations, including the in-situ resource utilization, meaning things like life support system, communications, mining equipment, and to collect surface ice for water, etc. as well. So 100 kilowatts is not that big.
Keep a few houses that's going,
that,
running.
That's, well, that's all, I suppose, all it needs to do.
But the thing about it, of course, they're not light and small. I reckon something like that would weigh about 15 metric tons, and that's a lot of mass to launch into space and land on the moon. So some ways away, but how far away, I don't know. Speaking of Artemis 3, which is the first return to the moon planned by NASA, that is now slated for 2027. But some say that's probably not that realistic, considering that the planned lander, which is going to be built by SpaceX, the one called Starship, it's a long way from being ready. And in the meantime, of course, China is targeting the year 2030 for its first crewed mission. And they seem to be better of late of keeping to their timetable. So if Artemis slips any... Again, this is another geopolitical issue, isn't it? When they want to get back, NASA and the Americans want to get back to the moon before China get there. It's like another space race all over again, yes, like we had back in the 60s.
Yep. I omitted to say that the International Space Station is back in our evening skies on September the 10th to the 28th, just if you want to put that in your diary. This gap seems like for ages from the August one. It's another 3 weeks to go thereabouts before it comes back into our evening skies again. So, of course, we have a very bright moon tonight, not forgetting that. And just to reiterate, just get out there if you can to see the Perseid meteor shower as well. Now, loads of things, little things going on, I suppose. Marking 13 years on Mars, NASA's Curiosity picks up some new skills. And the engineers are finding ways to make NASA rover even more productive. The six-wheeled robot has not been given more autonomy, and the ability to multitask, and of course improvements designed to make the most of Curiosity's energy source, which is important as the dust blows onto the panels and things. They've got to be very careful how they use the power as well. So it's doing detective work, which involves a lot of energy. Besides driving and extending a robotic arm to study rocks and cliff sides, Curiosity has a radio, it has cameras, 10 science instruments that all need power, and so to do, the multiple heaters that keep the electronics, the mechanical parts, the instruments operating at their best. These would be some of the things that the normal you and me, Ben, well, although we know about these things, but they're all on Curiosity, all the things that have to be there, and they use a bit of power as well. So let's hope that the panels stay pretty clean and more power is generated from the very same sun that lights our little sky as well. So it's remarkable to think, isn't it? It's miles and miles to go for that one. So that's just marking 13 years on Mars, and we've been following that.
Thank you, John. Yeah, next door. Whoops. Next door in the Alpha Centauri system, the nearest star system to our sun, only 4.5 light years away or so. I see the James Webb Space Telescope has discovered or seems to have directly imaged a planet. It's a big gas giant, a bit like our own Jupiter or Saturn, and it is, of course, the nearest gas giant that we know of. I know some have been discovered much further away, and they reckon it is lifeless, but again, like our own Jupiter and Saturn, it could have moons that could sustain life. Life as we know it, Jim, with liquid water. But they did discover it, and then it kind of disappeared, and now they have to go back looking for it again, because it is very difficult to spot. You have to remember, of course, especially with direct imaging, because the light from the star itself just tends to outshine everything that would be very close to it, like the planet itself. But they think it'd be a long time before anyone gets there. I was just thinking if you could, I was reading some time ago about solar sails and a very, very small little, that's probe, maybe the size of a mobile phone that you could attach to this solar sail that would be maybe an acre or 2 acres wide. And mm-hmm. It could, in theory, accelerate it to about a quarter the speed of light, which means it would take about 20 years and to get to Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri, which wouldn't be too long in terms of, if you compared it with trying to build a metro or something in this country, but send back a little picture, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
And of course, the picture itself or any data that comes back would be travelling at the speed of light and would only take 4.5 years to get back. So you might find something in 24.5 years or so.
Just
a little picture
really.
of a different solar system or a different close-up picture of a different star.
Yeah, at the speed of light, 4.5 years to get here. Oh, geez, the size of this place where this universe we're habitating. Is that the right word? Yep. Do you remember a big meteorite or a little meteorite that punched a hole through a Georgia roof? That's in Georgia in the US earlier this year. They reckon now, a little bit of research done, that it may be older than the Earth itself.
Wow.
Four and a half billion years. My goodness.
It's
called the McDonough meteorite. It's 23 grams worth. That's all that got back to Earth. Yeah. It was a little bit bigger when it went.
An ounce.
Yeah, that's all it is. Yep, an ounce. And it's only the same size as just holds in between two fingers, so looks like a pebble on the beach.
You seen that video a few months ago of somebody's camera on their door, on the front door?
Yeah, that was brilliant.
And just this meteorite, just a tiny pebble now, but it just went bang into the... did it hit the porch or the car?
It hit a porch.
Recently just, went through a car. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been a few knocking around and probably a few more to come as well.
And the one that hit Ireland, that went through the roof of an... Or did you see that picture from the RUC station in 1969, the Bovida meteorite that went through the roof? I've seen the picture of that big hole in the roof. I think that was a big enough rock too. Anyway, we'll be careful on the way home.
They're out there.
Coming for you.
Yeah, we got bombarded every single day in life, so only tiny little ones, grains of sand, so they wouldn't get through, but the bigger ones sneaked through, the Chelyabinsk one being one of the most recent one, I suppose. And it broke up and it disintegrated, essentially, but the pressure waves broke windows, they hurt people, they blew in doors and factories and all sorts of things. So keep your head down. Although they say that you have a fat chance of getting hit by a meteorite, but wrong place, wrong time.
Well, mm-hmm. I'm happy to say you've better chance of winning the lotto, and let's face it, the odds of that are not very good. I think we have to go now, Joan.
Yes,
I did just want to mention that the NASA's Lunar Trailblazer mission did end without managing to map the moon, and NASA lost contact with the spacecraft one day after the launch last February, and they never regained communication. But despite they've been trying ever since then to regain communication, but they have not succeeded, and so on last Friday, NASA officially said it's gone, lost, over.
Mm-hmm. Over.
Speaking of over, we're over again for another evening. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your texts, especially your nice words from Ashley and Mikla. Thank you very much. Don't forget, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and thanks to John for his news items. And that's all from me, Ben Emmett, for this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM, where it's music all the way now until 2 a.m. because up next we have Dublin's greatest hits, and from 10 p.m. to midnight, Nigel Wood has his ear to the globe, and from midnight to 2 a.m. Dave Barry, his after-hours program mix is a mix of jazz, blues, and soul. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. Say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.